Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Josh Kranzberg, in for Jason McClure. To put it simply, Bill Plant doesn't stop working. Since starting as a correspondent for CBS News in New York in 1964, Plant has traveled the world multiple times over, covering the biggest stories in the past 50 years. From the Selma marches to the Vietnam War, to every presidential campaign since 1968, Bill Plant has done it all and done it well, winning multiple Emmys for his work. From 1981 to 1989, he was a White House correspondent. For the next 3 years, he covered the U.S. State Department and is now the senior White House correspondent for CBS and says he has no plans of retiring anytime soon. Bill Plant joins us today on Global Journalist. Mr. Plant, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Josh. Pleasure to be here.
I guess I'll start. Let's get a sense of who you are. How did you get interested in journalism?
Well, you know, I watched television as a kid. I saw Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite in all kinds of exotic places. And I was particularly struck, I think, by what Murrow did in the McCarthy hearings and then in broadcasts like Harvest of Shame. It struck me that this was important work. And I started in broadcasting really as a lark. I was about 17 years old. I wanted to work on the radio. I asked for a job, and they said, no, we don't have anything, but we'll call you. Well, you know, that means they never call you, right?
Exactly.
But they did. They called me 2 weeks later and said, hey, you want to work out at the transmitter? You know, taking logs of the transmitter readings and running commercials? I said, sure. Which the lesson there is just get your foot in the door any way you can.
Of course.
And a couple of weeks later, I got my first chance at being on the radio.
So if you weren't a journalist, what would you have been?
I started out to be a lawyer.
Really?
My father wanted his children all to have professions. He had grown up in the Depression. I started law school after I graduated from Loyola University Chicago. I was immediately bored. It was stultifying. And I withdrew. Now, this caused a firestorm at home.
I would imagine.
And I had to get a job quickly. There was no option to kind of hang around the house. So I was able to get a job in Milwaukee at a television station doing being the an announcer and also doing weekend news, which was appealing to me because it was a chance to do what I'd watched people like Murrow do. Well, kind of.
What attracted you to journalism in the first place? You say Walter Cronkite and Edward Murrow, but what was it about journalism that really drew you in?
It was about telling compelling stories and what I thought were important stories. For example, it was pretty obvious that the people who were profiled in Harvest of Shame were exploited. They were braceros. They were temporary workers brought up from Mexico and Central America working in the orange groves in Florida. They were horribly exploited. It was pretty obvious, obvious enough for a teenager to say, hey, that's good that somebody's talking about that.
Okay. You've been with CBS, as I said, for more than 50 years. What is it about that network in particular that has made you want to stay with them as opposed to go to CNN, NBC, ABC?
There might have been a couple of times when I could have moved, but I always thought CBS was the gold standard, or as the saying goes, the Tiffany Network. I liked it. They gave me a lot of opportunity, so I never really wanted to leave.
Okay. So you've been a reporter now. Half a century. What makes a good reporter?
Somebody who's curious, who's willing to follow up on that curiosity by asking questions and considering that there may be more than one answer to the same question and being able to and wanting to synthesize various points of view or to say, okay, here's what some people think and here's what others think. And here are the facts on the ground. And not being wed to one answer is what I'm getting at. The ability to say, okay, there may be some nuances here. So let's consider what is going on.
You talk about telling stories. You've been telling them for a while. And obviously things have changed quite a bit in the world of journalism since you started. Other than the obvious ones, technology, Facebook, Twitter, although that might be the answer, what has changed the most?
The speed at which we gather and disseminate news is the thing that has changed the most. When I started covering the White House in 1981, the news at 6:30 on the three networks, there were only three, was what we said it was. We were the one, the professional journalists, mainly our bosses, not us, were the ones who decided what the news of the day was and in what order it should be presented. Now, of course, you can choose your own news, and people do. And they don't have to wait for 6:30 to get it. So the speed of everything has changed the way we all do business. Now, I don't sit around and say, hey, those were the good old days, because I think we have to live in the present. And the question then becomes, how do you make what people get, the information that people get, good to be good information? How do you inform the public? How do you teach the public that they have to understand where their news is coming from? The viewer himself or herself is now responsible for vetting their own news. You have to be able to say, do I trust that source? What facts was I just given? What are the sources? What's the attribution? Is it the reporter saying that? Or did the reporter attribute it to person A and B?
Do you feel journalism has gotten better or worse or stayed the same with all of these changes?
Well, I mean, there's a lot more room for error because there are very few professional vetters who have a lot of influence. I mean, we're still out there to vet the news. We still select for you, but you don't all come to us. You go in many different directions.
Do you feel that fracturing of news? You said yourself, it's not the big three anymore. There's CNN, MSNBC, Fox, and then you have international news outlets, BBC, Al Jazeera. Do you feel that's hurt journalism, or do you think it's made it better, or how has that changed things?
I think on balance it helps to have many points of view. The problem, such as it is, is that people can draw their news from many sources, but there's no guarantee that what they get has been thoroughly vetted. So you're your own overseer, your own gatekeeper.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Joshua Kranzberg, in for Jason McClure. This week, a conversation with longtime CBS News correspondent Bill Plant. A reminder that if you're interested in more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read in-depth articles on international affairs and free press issues, and download past episodes from our archive. We're also on social media. Be sure to like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Global Jurn.
President Obama is heading to Europe tonight, first to Poland for meetings on the crisis in Ukraine, and then to Belgium and France for ceremonies marking the 70th anniversary of the D-Day invasion. Our senior White House correspondent, Bill Plant, will be covering that, as he did the 50th anniversary in 1994.
We're at the other side of the cemetery on the seawall, just a stone's throw from Omaha Beach.
Just one of the many stories Bill Plant has covered since he joined CBS News 50 years ago this week. Congratulations, Bill.
You've covered the biggest stories around the globe. If you had to pick one of them as your, say, favorite or the most interesting to cover, which one would you pick?
I go back to the beginning. I covered the civil rights movement as a very young reporter. I also covered Vietnam. Those are the two. I love politics, and I love covering politicians, which I've done most of my professional life. But those two stories, the civil rights movement in Vietnam, were probably, I think, the most influential in my worldview. I had a hard time separating my own feelings when I covered the civil rights movement, because obviously I thought that they were on the right side. And yet I had a job to do. I had to interview the people who thought otherwise, too. And I had to say what their reasons were for wanting to continue segregation, even though I thought, you know, personally, I didn't agree.
So you not only covered the civil rights marches 50 years ago, but you covered the 50th anniversary earlier this year. You went back to Selma. Tell me about that. Tell me about the emotions that you felt 50 years ago and the emotions that you felt earlier this year when you went back.
50 years ago, when I covered the civil rights, the voting rights movement in Alabama, the atmosphere was threatening. The people in charge, the white power structure, did not welcome, obviously, Dr. King and the people from SNCC and the SCLC down there to organize black voters. Organizing black voters meant upending the power structure as it existed. So obviously they weren't for it. And there were elements that were threatening. Ku Klux Klan and people who were willing to do violence as we saw, not only when Sheriff Jim Clark and the Alabama troopers attacked the marchers at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, but also when, a couple of days later, two men beat a white minister named James Reeb so badly that he died. And at the end of the March on Montgomery 3 weeks later, Ku Klux members, Klan members, shot to death a woman from Detroit who was ferrying marchers back to Selma. So those dangers were very real. And we knew that going in. But we also have to admit that one of the reasons that the civil rights movement chose the area around Selma, Alabama, as a place to demonstrate was because of the opposition they knew they would face in a hardcore sheriff like Jim Clark.
Of course. Describe to me that emotion when 50 years since the original marches, you saw President Obama walk across that bridge with civil rights leaders of today. And then you have it was John Lewis, the congressman who took part in the marches 50 years ago. Describe that emotion as you were covering it.
John Lewis, to me, is the key figure in all this. John Lewis, when he was in his 20s, led the march, one of the two leaders of the march on March 6th, 1965, which got to the foot of the bridge and the marchers were beaten and gassed, run down by mounted deputies. And John Lewis, who has been serving in Congress now for many years from the Atlanta area, is one of the modern heroes of the civil rights movement. And to see him back there on that bridge 50 years later was quite an emotional moment, because he's the real deal. Without people like him who believed wholeheartedly and sincerely in nonviolence, there would never have been a successful nonviolent civil rights movement in this country.
You said that one of the challenges you had while covering those marches was maintaining objectivity because you felt that the civil rights movement was a valid issue. Did you feel that way as you were covering the Vietnam War, that America should leave Vietnam or that America should stay in Vietnam? Did you have those concerns?
I got sent to Vietnam and I'd been with CBS for about 3 months, even before I went to Selma. And I didn't know diddly, as we say, the professional term. I had no idea what I was walking into. I was there for only 2 months that time, but I got sent back in 1967 and began by that time, because the protests against the war were taking shape, to have a better idea of what was at stake. And I could see in 1967 that the facts on the ground didn't match what we were being told every day at the briefings in Saigon. It was pretty apparent to all of us. You didn't have to be particularly, psychic to understand what was happening. They gave us totals of enemy killed in action every day, but the enemy was still very active, no matter how many they reported as killed. And there didn't seem to be any let-up, no matter how many they reported as killed. So something was obviously not working here. They claimed that it was, and General Westmoreland famously said that he told Congress that he could see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Was it tough then reporting that information to the public, knowing in the back of your mind that it was either fabricated or completely wrong or exaggerated?
Well, it probably wasn't so much fabricated as it was simply the spewing out of statistics. Okay, here's what they said about the number of people killed today. What we didn't get to do every day was suggest that perhaps that didn't make any difference, because you can't do that without, doing opinion writing, mm-hmm. unless you had somebody who was saying that it wasn't so, which was happening in the States, but not when we were in Vietnam. But it bred distrust of the government, and that probably was a very healthy thing.
Out of all the stories you've covered, which has been the hardest to cover?
I think probably the civil rights movement.
And why is that?
Well, for the reason that we just discussed, which was about my own feelings and keeping them out of it, and for seeing people suffer the way they did. Of course, the same thing was true seeing people die in Vietnam. War is an awful thing. You might think when you're young that it's exciting, and in some ways it is. But when you see people dying, it's beyond exciting. It's tragic. And the older you get, the better you understand that.
Let's turn now to your coverage as a presidential campaign correspondent. You've covered almost 50 years of that as well. What's been your favorite presidential campaign to cover, or the most memorable?
Well, they're all fun. I suppose that one of the most memorable was the first one I ever covered, which was being a junior reporter on Richard Nixon's 1968 campaign. The main CBS reporter was Mike Wallace. And I was one of the junior guys. I described myself as Mike Wallace's bag carrier. But it was my first sort of real close-up. I'd covered George Romney earlier that year, but it was my first real close-up of big-time politics in action. I grew up in a political family in Chicago, so I had some idea how politics worked, but never seen it quite on the same industrial scale as you get in a presidential campaign. It was fun. We went everywhere in a chartered airplane. We saw a lot. We learned a lot. And yet, when you watch the candidate and compared him, and then we went and covered Hubert Humphrey for about a week. Just they switched us off. The total energy and dynamic was completely different. So you got a sense of how different candidates operated, how they campaigned. It was fun.
And you caught the bug, and you've been
doing
it
ever
since.
Oh, yeah, ever since.
So you've been a White House correspondent for a number of years now, the senior White House correspondent for CBS. You cover the ins and outs of the president and the West Wing. In 2013, you said that President Obama was, quote, undercutting the First Amendment, and you called it state-run media. How different is the Obama administration compared to others when it comes to media relations and all that?
The only difference between the Obama administration and all of its predecessors, which I've covered back to the Reagan administration, is that they now have the tools to get their own information out to the public, and they use the same tools we do. In the old days, as I said earlier, the news was what we said it was. Now, they have their own avenues to put out news as well. And what that comment that you quoted specifically referred to was a controversy at the time over the use of photographs posted on the White House Flickr account, taken by White House photographers and available to the media to use, of events which were not open to the photographers who normally cover the White House. The photographers were bitter about this, and so were the writers. We didn't blame them. The whole idea was that the White House got to pick the images. That's why I called it state-run media.
But
it was a very sore point. The White House didn't like it at all.
But isn't that, not to dispute what your characterization of it, but isn't that sort of the same thing as what White Houses have done for years, administrations have done for years? They've picked and chose certain pictures that show the president in a flattering light or a more favorable light than others?
They're welcome to do that if we have the same opportunity to get those pictures. But we didn't. Yes, there have always been incidences where there's a closed event, and there's a picture that they put out of a particular moment of the president doing, signing this bill or greeting that leader, and there's some reason why we couldn't all be there. Okay, fair enough. And we choose to use it. We can either identify the fact that it's theirs or not. But if it is an event that could have been covered by the people who are normally there every day, and they choose not to let us in because they don't want us yelling a question or for whatever reason, then they're controlling the media.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Joshua Kranzberg in for Jason McClure. This week we're talking with longtime journalist Bill Plant, who's been with CBS for more than 50 years and is currently the network's senior White House correspondent. He's won a number of awards over his career and recently was awarded an honor medal from the Missouri School of Journalism. Mr. Plant, what is your advice to the next generation of journalists who are at this school right now, getting ready to graduate and go out into the real world?
The people who are studying right now have an amazing bag of tools at their disposal, tools that most of us never had, and tools that most of us are still struggling to learn. So you take advantage of that, but you find out how to use it responsibly so that the material, the information you send out is information that you can guarantee is good.
What do you think the biggest cause for concern is? When you're looking at the state of journalism today and where it's going, what's your biggest concern?
The fact that it comes in minute sound bites, even more minute than the ones we use every night on television. You can't really convey the essence of an argument in 120 characters or in three short sentences. You can get close to it maybe, but you're not there. It's the paucity of information, the lack of depth. That, to me, is the biggest concern. But people have to be willing to go deeper, and they often are not, which is the argument that will be made by those who say, okay, let's give them something rather than nothing. All right, but...
You'd rather have nothing than a canned soundbite or something that's...
Not nothing, but I'd rather have somebody say, wait a minute, there's a lot more here. Here are some other things that you should be thinking about.
You're a journalist, obviously. Your wife is an Emmy Award-winning producer, and three of your six children are journalists. It's obviously in the water. Why do you think your kids got into the business? Was it after seeing you guys do it and do it well?
I'll tell you the real reason I think that three of them are journalists. They saw growing up that I had a good time. I wasn't home often enough. But obviously, I was enjoying my work. So maybe they thought that was something fun to do.
They saw you traveling around the world, and yeah. They figured, well, why don't we do that?
Yep.
Something a lot of people might not know about you, at least here in mid-Missouri, but certainly people in D.C. will know this. You're a wine connoisseur. In fact, calling you a wine connoisseur might be a disservice to you as a wine lover. You're apparently the person to go to if people are looking for a restaurant that has a great wine. You once described the feeling of turning people onto wine, similar as a missionary work. How did you get so interested in wine, and tell me about that?
Okay, when I was in college at Loyola University in Chicago, I didn't like beer. I've since come to appreciate good beer, but the beer that we drank back then was stuff that tasted like it had been passed through the wrong end of a horse. I mean, you know. So I didn't like it. So I would drink the cheap Chianti that came with the pizza instead. And I got just enough of a taste to think that this is interesting and to begin to explore it on my own when I got out of school and got into a job. And then I got an expense account and even better. I learned to love to experiment, to try different things. I still do. I'll always want to try the local wine wherever I am. I had some good Missouri wine last night here. the wine is made now in all 50 states.
Is it?
But not necessarily from grapes growing in those states, maybe from imported grapes in some cases.
So when I was doing my research, there's a story about you and then Governor of California, Ronald Reagan, and a bottle of wine. Can you please enlighten our audience about this?
We were on the campaign plane in 1980.
Okay, we'll go with 1980.
This time I've got it right. Yeah, he became president in 1981. So on the campaign plane, I carried a few bottles of wine in the overhead bin.
Why?
Well, just because we never knew where we'd wind up. There might not be a decent wine on the list. There were other wine lovers on the plane.
Okay.
So his communications director, Mike Deaver, came by one day. I had a bottle out. He said, what do you got? I said, well, it's a Cabernet from, I forget exactly which vineyard, Raymond, I think. And he said, well, here, give the governor some. So we marched up to the front and I showed the bottle to the governor. And the governor looked at me and said, are you Raymond? I said, no, governor, I'm Bill Plant from CBS. And his friend Mike Deaver said, try this. So Reagan tried it. And he said, this will probably be better after, 4 or 5 years, which is absolutely true.
Okay.
And he said, the fellas at the Wine Institute taught me that.
You've interviewed hundreds, probably thousands of people throughout your career. What's your favorite interview?
Well, that's a hard one. And I should be better prepared to answer it. But I'd have to say, Martin Luther King, who I interviewed a couple of times back early on. I've had a chance to interview, I think all of the presidents, including this one, which is always a little bit daunting because you have a limited amount of time, and presidents can do can influence how you interview goes by simply talking a long time and running you out of time. Filibustering is the word, I guess. So I'd have to say that the chance to be with so many people who are interesting people, movers and shakers, has always fascinated me.
What about the hardest interview you've ever done?
You got me. Maybe I'll think of it. Let's see.
Leaders from around the world.
Okay, yeah, one does come to mind. Thank you. President Jiang Zemin of China. There was a trade summit in Seattle during the Clinton administration. There were two or three of us interviewing Jiang, and they had expected written questions beforehand. We didn't give them to them. They were not happy. And of course, it was done through a translator. And it really was like pulling teeth.
We've got about a couple minutes left. What advice do you have for journalists today and future journalists and journalists right now?
Okay. Be curious. Ask questions. Don't be afraid to go there. Don't be afraid to ask what seems like an obvious question. Because sometimes the answers you get to obvious questions are answers that you wouldn't otherwise get. You can't take anything for granted. You have to go to the root every time. And you have to, when you get countervailing information, go to another source. You have to be willing to run it down.
What about the future of television news in general? We've talked about the advances in technology, Facebook, Twitter, all that. Where do you see TV news?
I don't know if the evening news broadcasts will be around forever, probably for another 10 years, maybe. Who knows? The other question is, look, we know who watches the evening news broadcasts on television. There's a demographic that is largely over 50. So here's the question. When today's 30-somethings become 50, will they watch an evening news broadcast? Maybe they will, maybe they won't, because there will be then, as there are already, a lot of other places to get news. So I don't know what the future is, but I do know that you could expect people to be getting news over radio, television, the internet, social media, in the sort of nonstop fashion for the foreseeable future.
And you'll be reporting, of course, because you said you're never going
to
retire.
I certainly hope to.
Well, that'll do it for this edition of Global Journalists, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Many thanks to Bill Plant for joining us on today's program. Our producers this week are Jake Godin, David Soler, Loretta Lee, and Shiwei Chu. Our studio director is Travis McMillan of RJI. For all of us here at Global Journalists, I'm Joshua Cranesburg. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.